Steve Fleck is the voice many people hear in their hardest moments, when their heart is jumping out of their chest, their mind is crushed, and the finish line is in sight. Fleck is broadcast commentator for athletics, cycling, endurance, and running competition. He's the familiar soundtrack to events streamed on media like CBC, Flow Bikes, Ironman Live, and others. But how does one become the voice of a sport, or anything else for that matter? Well, it starts by knowing your stuff. And in Steve's case, doing it. He was an early competitor in triathlon. He's a 9-time Ironman finisher with the best time of 9 hours and 4 minutes and competed in the Ironman World Championships. In addition to broadcasting, Steve has coached elite athletes and is a founding board member of the Canadian Endurance Sports Alliance. In this episode of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, Steve shares how his athletic career influenced his business career, how he transitioned from corporate work to a broadcasting career, and how he delivers a sense of the moment to his audience who aren't even there. He also offers a point of view on what event organizers should learn from the COVID era. It's a story of expertise, resourcefulness, resilience, and yes, endurance too. And it applies to anyone trying to do something great. Steve Fleck, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Thank you very much, Michael, for that wonderful introduction. I'm kind of, maybe the camera doesn't show up, but I am blushing. Very kind of you. Thank you.
Steve, so put it in context, and can you just kind of share with our audience, like, how did you get to this point?
It's been a long story. You probably are familiar, you know, Michael and Simon, with that graph of someone's career, how there's the straight line that sort of, you know, I think I should be going this way, that goes like that. And you're here and you want to get there, but it's never that straight line. It's the line kind of sort of wanders, you know, all over the place, and there's starts and stops, and there's setbacks, and there's valleys, and there's mountains, and there's peaks and valleys, et cetera, along the way. And it's kind of been definitely that way for me, you know, in terms of getting to where I'm at now, which is this almost 100% exclusive focus on race and event announcing, live race and event announcing at large, you know, marathons, triathlons, running events, track and field events, cycling as well. And then sort of live stream commentary and then event emceeing. It started off as one of those sort of side projects that I was working on. My background is in sales and marketing. I've done a lot of work in the sporting goods business for various business and brands, working in either straight up sales roles or marketing and communications roles. So that was my background. And I had been abruptly let go from a sales position about 7 or 8 years ago. I'm kind of lost track of time in the midst of time and a bit of pandemic brain. I think it was around 2014. I was abruptly let go from a sales position. The company was sold and, you know, people were superfluous and they were shedding staff, et cetera. So I was let go and a bunch of other people were let go. And that had happened to me once before. And it's just frustrating because, you know, it's nothing I did wrong. And a good business mentor of mine said, "Steve, you're a really good announcer. I think you should, you know, look into doing that, doing more of that." And he was super helpful in terms of fronting actually up some money for me to do that. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for, you know, him to do that. I did a bit of work for his company along the lines of business development and lead generation, which I still do to this very day. But he was very gracious in terms of fronting up some money to sort of get me going for the first half year. And then I just really hit it. And I applied, you know, a lot of those sort of business and sales 101 skills to growing my business as a race and event announcer. It's been a slow, you know, steady climb. 2020 was going to be my very best year. Absolute sort of peak year in terms of numbers, events, prestige of events, dollars that I would have made, and then the whole world shut down with COVID-19 and the pandemic. Live events were particularly hard, and I lost well over a year and a half of work. But there's other things that sort of came out of that. It was a reset, time to look inward, time to stretch a little bit in terms of some of the stuff I was doing. But that's the sort of the overall arc, Michael, in terms of how I arrived at where I'm at right now.
Steve, I mentioned on your profile is your science degree, the your physiology, etc., and biochemistry. That must be, I mean, it's a knowledge piece, but is that a a link? Was that an access point to drive you there in that particular area?
Great question, Simon. I often think of that myself, like what on earth am I doing with this BSc in biochemistry and nutrition from years ago from the University of Guelph? And I mean, the most logical step after that is into sort of medicine or research or something like that. And I actually thought about that. I went back to start my master's and I lasted one semester. I just said I was, kind of done with school and my heart just wasn't in it. But what it's given me, particularly as an athlete, is a strong foundation in the fundamentals of human physiology, of biochemistry and nutrition. And it's been more a sort of a life advantage to be able to separate, fact from fiction, understand what works for me as an athlete, but also now, as an older person, for just general nutrition and health. It's extraordinarily helpful information to know. I mean, you can make these things as, complicated as you want, nutrition, sport nutrition, human health, et cetera. But there's some basic fundamentals of it all that I learned in the, in the 4 years of that BSc that apply to really anything.
I'm guessing as well, Steve, that's giving you insight into, becoming, like you said, a better broadcaster, a better interviewer, a better energy, if you like, because you kind of know the science behind what you're seeing.
100%. That's the other advantage, I think, Simon, is when I'm, when I'm calling, a high level race, and I think this particularly applies to the higher level, commentary work that I'm doing for professional cycling or high level track and field or running, for that sort of thing. I know intimately, what's going on physiologically, with the athletes. I'm not an expert, but I have the basic, fundamental information, and I can sort of translate that into lay terms, for viewers, for listeners out there, so that they can understand what's going on with the athletes. So it's been extraordinarily helpful in that regard as well, 100%.
I want to take that transition, Steve, because, you are an endurance athlete yourself, and not that you're of a certain age, but you were also early days into triathlon, which back then wasn't particularly well known. And I remember those days of watching it on Wide World of Sports or whatever. It was almost this quirky thing of, look at what these people can do, and the testing the limits of human endurance. What is it about that you found appealing, and what have you taken from your life as an athlete that you apply to the other parts of your life?
I think there are a couple of things, Michael. One was the exploration of it all, and exploration in terms of my own limits, like pushing the body's limits to further and further, because that's what triathlon was like back then. It was like, how far can I run? How far can I ride? Can I swim across the lake? Can I ride from here to there? Can I ride from Toronto to Guelph? Can I do these things? So it was kind of a sort of a physical limits exploration, but also a geographic, if you will, or topographic sort of explanation of the terrain around me. There was also just the resiliency and the persistence required, to be successful, in any kind of endurance sport. It didn't matter. I mean, you have to be persistent. You have to be sort of resilient. Every day is not a home run. You just keep sort of grinding along. And I think I'm like that sort of, in my own sort of DNA and makeup. So it was a good fit for me. And there was also the pioneering aspect of it. I won't sort of deny the fact that it was kind of cool back then. You kind of hinted at that in your question. And this was early 1980s, mid 1980s. We didn't have a clue what we were doing. Triathlon was kind of this new, hip thing. And then layering on the exploration and the persistence and resistance, and then the sort of just feeling like a pioneer. Like it was this kind of unique and novel feeling, and packaged all that up together. And it was just a blast. I look upon those years, the mid to early 1980s, late 1980s into even the early 1990s as a special period in my life with, some tremendous sort of lessons learned.
Do you think, Steve, back then, knowing what you knew, I mean, would you have foreseen the rise in participation in triathlon that we've seen, or I mean, does this surprise you at all? What it's become?
Not really, because I think what I explained to you, Michael, in what was driving me on are deep sort of inner human urges that we want to get out there: exploration, pioneerism, uniqueness, novelty. You know, fighting back from maybe resistance to have sort of greater levels of persistence. I think people rest along, you know, a spectrum on all of those qualities, if you will. But I think, you know, triathlon spoke to a lot of that. And then I think the timing, you know, the timing was right. There was some incredible things that were, you know, going on, you know, in triathlon, in just generally in endurance sports, with numbers kind of, you know, building up. And I think then in the 2000s, there was a couple of catalytic events that, at least in North America, just took it to the whole sort of next level. And the one for me, I have a personal connection with this because he's a good friend of mine, is Simon Whitfield won that first Olympic gold medal for men in triathlon when triathlon made its debut in 2000, you know, at the Sydney Olympic Games. And for me personally, that was, you know, a very special moment. You know, it was obviously a special moment for Simon, but, you know, you saw that was on national television all across Canada. I mean, everyone saw that. It was on the front page of every newspaper the next day. It was the lead story on not just the sports networks, but the news of TV news of that night. So it was a pretty big and special moment. And then the other thing, and sorry, not to brag, but another good friend of mine, Graham Fraser, he had taken over sort of the rights to the Ironman races in North America and started to expand, you know, the Ironman races from the singular event that was in North America prior to 2000. That was Ironman Canada. And Graham started to expand those races around the sort of the continent. And that was what sort of initiated, you know, the big surge in growth of triathlon. And then everything else came along. I mean, cycling came along. There was, you know, the Grand Fondo started to come on in the late sort of 2000s, mass participation, charitable, you know, bike riding events, and marathons and running. And it all kind of peaked. If you look at the numbers, it all kind of peaked in the early 2010s. 2012, 2013 is when everything kind of peaked. And then everything flattened out. And the participatory numbers are either down for those particular disciplines and sports and activities that I'm talking about, or have either been flat for the past 10 years or just down slightly.
Let's take a kind of time out on your, you know, a skill set you have, which is incredible. That engagement of presenting, you know, being events, etc., a broadcasting. Question, I guess a two-part question, but how, you know, how have you got better at that? What, and have you made your name there? And how do we think outside of what is a core area of expertise to kind of build our own, if you like, engagement and speaking and the communication inside a business? Because, you know, we kind of sit or stand in awe of broadcasting and broadcasters. They seem to know everything. They seem to be most of the time on cue, et cetera, et cetera. What, you know, what are the skills that you've acquired to do that? And how could that be helpful? Because I'm thinking in a business side in how we communicate and speak, there's got to be lessons learned from what you've done.
That's a really involved question, Simon. I don't even know where to begin, but I think in my world, there are two different worlds. So there's live PA work, say at a large, you know, big city marathon, you know, 20,000, you know, finishers, you know, that's one role. And one job. It's the commentary job. So say live stream commentating, that work that I do for Flow Bikes or, you know, Runner Space for, you know, high level track and field. It may seem the same, but it's very different. They're similar, but related. I'll start with the sort of the mass participation, you know, what I call PA sort of live announcing work. And you mentioned how I learned. Well, I was really fortunate early on to either work alongside or listen a lot to, you know, two very important, you know, trend setters and pioneers in that space. One was Steve King at Ironman Canada. He was sort of the legendary announcer associated with that particular event. And then Mike Riley with the other sort of Ironman races and events in the Ironman World Championship. So all of us have our own unique style and do what we do, but listening to those two great announcers and, you know, to a certain degree, copying, you know, a bit of what they did and learning their pitch and tone of voice and style and energy, you know, at a finish line, you kind of, you know, get what people want. And then really it's about, as you had said, Simon, it's the engagement piece. And the singular thing I've learned is that people, and this is an ego thing, people love their name. So whenever you call out someone's name, you know, Simon Daw coming across the finish line here at, you know, such and such marathon. Wow. I've immediately got the attention, you know, of that person, you know, out on the run course. And even better if I identify something that they're wearing, like that funny red hat or that they're running for such and such a club or they're fundraising for this charity. And you know, the next question would be, well, how do you know all this? Well, that's where the research starts for, you know, for the racing event, knowing who the charities are, knowing who some of the clubs are, knowing who this, that, and the next thing, working with the, you know, the racing event organization to, you know, get as much of that information to me as possible, or me going out on my own to sort of find that information. Then a bit of technology as well. I mean, we don't know 2,000 people's names or 20,000 people's names. We get help from the timing companies that have a readout coming out in front of us so that person's name pops up when they, you know, get within 50 meters of the finish line or they cross the finish line. And so that role is very distinct, and it's about building the experience for the individual participant and amplifying their stories if you can. That's the way I define sort of that role. It requires high energy. It requires sort of, you know, being able to speak on the fly and ad lib and literally make stuff up as you go. You know, you have to be sort of quick on your feet because it's happening, you know, like this, like every, you know, 5 or 6 seconds, you know, people are sort of flooding across the finish line. So you need to sort of go with this, and you tend to sort of just sort of get in the flow, you know, as it goes, but it literally can go on for hours, like at a big city marathon, you're there until the final finisher comes across. So that's that particular piece. The live stream commentary was something that, again, you know, we're really lucky here in Canada. We've had just some incredible, you know, expert commentators and hosts for things like the Olympic Games on CBC. And I'm sure, you know, the BBC is the same. I mean, there's and NBC in the US, there's these people that have just become legendary within, you know, their sport. Michael, I can think of, you know, Rowdy Gaines in swimming, for example. I mean, yeah. Rowdy's incredible. I mean, you just listening to him, he knows everything about swimming. And so you listen to those people a lot. And again, you try and apply, you know, what they're doing to what you do in terms of your delivery for live stream commentary. You're not as much as a circus clown. You're not yelling and screaming, you know, and getting people really, really excited. Although you do want to engage with a lot of data. So that role does require a lot of research. And sometimes you get some help with that, you know, bios from the races and events, track meets, et cetera, that I'm working with. A lot of it is left up to me, and thank God for Google, because you can just put, you know, someone's name, an athlete or runner's name, you know, Usain Bolt into Google, and Wikipedia's got the whole, like his whole career there for you to research and craft some notes from. So I don't know how my contemporaries did that before Google. Every time I go to a big track meet, I'm thinking, like, how on earth did they do this prior to like 2000 with no internet? It's just incredible how the commentators and hosts and expert commentators from that era prior to the internet, I don't know how they did it. I mean, it's just incredible. So that role, that's what that role is all about. And it's very data driven. There's an expectation that you know a lot about the particular sport or discipline you're working on. And you, for me, some of it's easy because I reach back into my own personal experience as an athlete, as a runner, as a cyclist, as a triathlete. because I came from the world of triathlon, I know, you know, swimming, cycling, and running intimately. So I can draw on, draw on that, very heavily. And then the sort of the research piece. And then there's the drama. I mean, the athletes are really the story, and nothing's better than the 800 meters, which is, to me, in track and field is the perfect event. It's 2 minutes long, a little bit less for the men, about 2 minutes for the women, but the whole drama of a great race can be packed into those 2 minutes. And in highly competitive, 800 meter races, it invariably comes down to the final 50 meters with, last going to first going to last. I mean, it can just get absolutely, crazy. And that's when you get really excited. And I think it's part of a play-by-play person to really engage with the audience there. You can't see them. They're just out there in the ether, over the live stream or the TV or wherever it is. And you bring the drama and you bring it up to a crescendo, to the finish. Sorry, I really rambled on.
Yeah, no, Steve, I think that's a great answer. And, what you've just talked about really is the sense of the moment that a good announcer can bring. And several years ago, there was a test for, I think it was NFL games, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, where they decided to broadcast a game without announcers. And it was just crowd noise, right?
Yeah.
And it really wasn't the same. Of course, if you're at a game or if you're at an event, you're not hearing necessarily too much of the announcers. So you're kind of experiencing it in the moment, but it really wasn't the same. And conversely, there's also times when maybe the announcers almost step into it too much and they're almost in the way Yes. of the moment or the athletes. And so I think it takes a real talent that, that reflects probably for you a sense of what this really means, but also because you're an athlete yourself, you've been through those experiences. And so you know what it's like to be them as well.
100%. And again, the experience piece, Michael, was I was really lucky to work early on in that sort of commentary piece with some really great people. I mean, if you follow track and field, you'll know these names, Paul Swangard and Bob Akamian, two of the absolute best sort of live stream sort of commentators working in track and field. And I got to early on doing this, I got to work alongside both Paul and Bob, and they're amazing. And it's about, like when you start off in the morning with the heats and the preliminaries, you're not going at a 10 or an 11, right? Like Bob sort of pulled me aside and said, Steve, it's just the preliminaries. We're working at a 2 or a 3 right now. We save it for the finals coming up later on this afternoon. That's when we really sort of let it loose and throw the emotion and the drama sort of back, at the microphone. And those are important lessons to learn, because if you didn't know that, I've listened to sort of live streams, with sort of newbies who, are doing this, and they're operating at 10 or 11, at 9 o'clock in the morning for the heats and the preliminaries. And like, there's nowhere to go, right? if you're already there. So you sort of have to build it up like throughout the day. So again, those were, important moments and important lessons to, to learn, early on, and save your best stuff for, when the best are, on the track doing their best is really what it's all about.
I want to talk a little bit, Steve, about resilience. And I've done a number of marathons myself, and it's one of the things I've learned from my own running is that, there's so much about the training and the preparation, which applies in business, applies in life as well. But there's also a whole lot about the mental side of it. And when I would do tempo runs, which were uncomfortable, pace kind of thing, what I sort of tried to trick my mind into is, and it sounds so counterintuitive, is to relax into the pain, because I know it's coming and I know it's going to hurt. But if I was anticipating it, I'd be slowing down and I'd be trapped in that mindset. And so it helped me in a way. But can you talk about, your life as an athlete, what you see from other athletes, those lessons of resilience and how they might apply to regular life to other people?
Yeah, that's a hard one, because I think a lot of this is about our own sort of DNA, Michael, and how, how we're made up, what motivates us. Are we more, externally motivated or more internally sort of motivated? I mean, I, you know, I'm thinking back to when, you know, I was an athlete. I mean, I loved the training. I mean, I was a trainer. I probably left some of my best actually performance, like pure human performances, you know, out on the training track, or push myself way too hard trying to keep up with, other athletes. I mean, but that's just the way I was. I loved the training. I loved immersing myself sort of in the process, and I sometimes to the detriment of the absolute sort of, you know, ultimate performance in that A race sort of at the end of the year. So I never needed to, you know, be reminded about, you know, getting out there and getting after it. And it's difficult for me to talk. I know resilience is a big thing in sort of business, you know, these days. And I agree with you. There's lots of transfer over from endurance sports, you know, with the training and, you know, just all those cliches, you know, immerse yourself in the process. It's all about the journey. You know, there's ups and there's downs. You just have to sort of keep at it every day, have a routine, you know, and all these things. I'm not meaning to make light of these things, but I think some people are just they fall into that somewhat naturally. And I think I'm lucky in that way. I don't know. I'm not an expert, and I don't know what those cues are for someone who would, you know, need more of that kind of help in their own personal life or their business life. Because for me, it's just been natural. I mean, I take the same level of persistence, relentlessness, and resiliency to, you know, my business career, you know, as I do to, you know, when I was an athlete. And we've talked about that. I mean, you know, every day is not a great day. Sometimes you're going out, you know, for a bike ride and it's 10 degrees Celsius and pouring rain. It's not that pleasant, but you know, you get out there and you get after it. I'm always at a loss to, you know, to try and like explain this or use word cues or examples to sort of, you know, explain it to other people. I think I just lead by example. And if people can draw, you know, from that, then great. I hope that sort of answered your question.
Steve, you just touch on a particular attribute, a persistence, and you talk about the three P's and how you bring, you know, the essence of confidence with sales teams, etc. Just share with us a bit more about us and maybe let us into a few secrets.
Sure. Well, again, I don't think they're real secrets, Simon. Sales is really difficult. I found, you know, sales work when I was working, you know, for companies, you know, difficult and challenging, but I just got at it for the longest time. You know, when I was early on in the sales jobs that I was in, you're getting all caught up in, you know, the emotion of it all, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, ultimately it's a numbers game as both of you, you know, gentlemen know in, you know, successful business, and you just keep plugging away. And I think that's where the persistence, you know, and the resistance and the resiliency comes up, is you just keep plugging away. I don't know if these numbers ring true, but they certainly feel like they do. Is that, I mean, if you want one or two conversions or one or two people to sort of buy into your product or service, reach out to 100, 10 are going to be kind of interested, 5 really interested, you convert on 2. So you got to plug a lot of stuff like into the funnel to have those, the one or two, like fall out, you know, at the bottom. And those numbers are brutal. They're kind of sobering, but you know, that's the reality, you know, of the situation. I often find it funny when I'm talking to people about, you know, me selling myself. I think I'm good at what I do. I don't like to sort of build myself up, you know, too much. But I, you know, when you're in business for yourself, you kind of have to do that. And people think it's just because you're good at what you do, it's just automatic. Like my phone's ringing off the hook. Well, I had just before I got on the phone call with you guys or this Zoom call to record this podcast. I mean, I had 3 people, you know, kind of turn me down this morning. So, I mean, it's just, that's just the way it goes. And you just keep going sort of on and on and on, and you develop the, you know, the contact database, and, you know, stuff falls out. Sometimes it falls out, you know, just happenstance, like you don't know why it falls out. And then in other times, there's you can see sort of a direct sort of, you know, connection to it all. I don't know if that answered your question, Simon, but that's sort of been my experience, you know, of sales. And the lessons learned from that persistence, resiliency, and relentlessness piece from my experience in endurance sports are very applicable.
You said something recently where you said something like the hard work is finding the work.
Yeah. That's for me. It is. It's like, I remember talking to a booking agent for a musical act here in the Toronto area. And it's somewhat the same for them, for bands. I mean, they love performing. Like if you're a musician, there's nothing that gives you greater pleasure than being up on a stage performing. But finding the work is the work. And that's the way it is for me. I mean, no one has to force me to go out and, you know, do live commentary, you know, at a track meet, or, you know, go to a marathon and, you know, announce, you know, at that. But finding it is, it's not without its challenges. And that really is where the work is. That's what is, you know, significantly time consumptive, you know, for me, you know, having, you know, the year lined up. I mean, the last 2 years has been, you know, been extraordinarily challenging in that regard, because the work has been few and far between. But it gave me time to sort of, I think, reconnect with a lot of prospects that I had kind of sort of given up on. And I never give up, you know, on a prospect. So I just, you know, keep going, keep the engagement going, check in with them, see what's happening in their world, you know, try and sort of relate at their level to whatever their challenges are. And if I can provide a solution that's, you know, going to make their world better or their value offering more valuable, then, you know, maybe we can work together.
Yeah. And kind of along those lines, Steve, you know, COVID was such a, you know, an incredible impact on the world. And particularly if you're in the events industry, and whether that's sports events or music or whatever, you know, everything was shut down. What do you think might be sort of the lasting lessons for either people in live events and or just businesses in general that remains from COVID? If we have this conversation 5 years from now and we're looking back on it historically, what do you think we'll say then? Like, what did we take away?
I think what had happened, Michael, was that live events had taken their viewers, their participants, their customers, their guests. I think they had started to take them for granted, that they would always come out, that we would put on the music concert and people would buy tickets. We would, you know, put out the registration for the triathlon and everyone would sign up. We would organize this food festival, this arts event, and people would just come. I think that is what had happened, because it always had happened that way. There had been literally no disruption, you know, to, you know, these businesses, and particularly the endurance sports business. As I had mentioned, it's been a long sort of buildup, and then things stabilized, but the people just kept coming. I mean, if you had 10,000, you know, participants last year, well, you'll get 10,000, you know, participants, you know, this year. You really didn't have to do much to get that 10K sort of out again. It wasn't growing, but 10,000 was a good number for your, you know, your particular event. So I think what happened was that was taken away. The revenue from those 10,000 people was taken away, or the people coming to the concert, all gone. And early on, there was sort of panic setting in about, you know, what we were going to do. But I think some smart people in the business said, there's two things we have to do. We have to keep up engagement, like with our participants, with our customers, with our ticket buyers, and we have to keep up engagement, you know, with our sponsors, because that's everything. I mean, take those two away and we have nothing. So the really good events, any kind of live event, as we've talked about, I'm deepest in the world of endurance sports, sort of races and events, running, cycling, and triathlon. They really up their game, you know, on the engagement front with participants. They launched podcasts, they had contests, they had virtual, you know, virtual runs that got sort of a trickle of income, you know, coming in, but provided that engagement piece, you know, with the participant. And they reached out to sponsors and made sure that the sponsors, you know, were engaged, because we want to make sure that, you know, maybe the sponsor is being renewed at the end of, you know, this year or next year. Heaven forbid we haven't done anything for them and they just walk away. So we have to create sort of engagement to make sure that they feel like they're getting, you know, let's be clear, the sponsor needs, you know, business value out of it, that they're getting sort of the value out of whatever engagement you are creating. But the creative juices, Michael, that came out like in my particular sector was pretty impressive. That did open doors for me, actually, which was welcome, in that, you know, everyone wanted content. And people often said, well, Steve, why don't you do your own, you know, your own podcast and, you know, host your own podcast. And I said, well, that'd be great, but I'd have 10 people listening to me. But what I did was I went back to my clients, the events, and I said, I'll host a podcast, or I'll interview a sponsor, or I'll interview a famous, you know, athlete, you know, for you. And then we put that content on your Facebook page or your website, or we'll stream it live, or whatever you want. I mean, it's a completely blank slate about, you know, what we could do here. So that opened up, you know, doors for me to, you know, to get a bit income, you know, coming in. And granted, it wasn't great money, because both of us were suffering, you know, and we sort of worked out some kind of honorarium, you know, type of arrangement with the events that I do that. I did it also with brands too, as well, that were looking for sort of unique, you know, unique content in the space. And I think I'm like you are, Michael, and you, Simon, are good interviewers. So it's a skill set, and, you know, it was extremely, you know, extremely helpful, you know, throughout the pandemic. But I think that was the piece that was missing, and that it had been taken for granted, was that sort of higher level engagement, you know, with the participant. And I think the lesson learned is we have to keep that up. Now we'll get back to normal. We're kind of doing that now. So races and events will go on. In some parts of the world, they're almost 100% sort of back to normal. Other places are lagging a little bit behind. But I think the lessons learned is we need to really up that sort of engagement piece away from race day and event day. We had been too much loaded up on, hey, it's just all about that one day, the one day that the 10K is running, the one day that the charitable sort of bike ride is running. And now we've got tools, activities, and other things that we can do to keep that engagement with the participant, with the customer, with the ticket holder, possibly 365 around the year.
Steve, though, how, you know, and you know, I guess we're on this show, and as an interviewer, we can challenge that. How do you calibrate that, though? Because if we only have 24 hours in a day or less, because we go to bed, and we go to races, we're listening to podcasts, we get podcasts from recipe shows, we get podcasts from music shows. We're saturating ourselves, and I know, you know, you'll agree with this, having had that experience in the social media piece, but how does that truly pan out? Because I can't give all of my time to listening to, you know, and I enjoy rugby, right? So I can watch the game, I can go live, I can listen to interviews, but there, you know, there's only a bit of the pie that I can give. So what, you know, challenge you on that, how does that calibrate? Do you see it as a continuous momentum, or something that'll just balance itself out, or do you honestly see it growing in both spaces in terms of the participation and going there and listening to a podcast?
Great question. I mean, all of that I was talking about, Simon, kind of grew out of desperation. So, you know, people just started doing it because they had nothing else to do. And obviously, you know, we had a bit of free time on our hands. But I think you're right. I think now more metrics sort of need to be, you know, applied to this. I mean, you know, hey, we produce this great podcast, but, you know, five people listen to it, when in fact we want 500 or 5,000 people to sort of listen to that. So what is that content that actually clicks with more people? I think that is a key thing. And I think now, you know, as we start to get back to normal, and lives become, you know, more busy and more back to normal, you know, I think that is a valid question that needs to be asked. I mean, in the early part of the pandemic, I mean, you know, I was in Canada. I mean, everyone was, and you were in the UK. I mean, everyone was locked down. You could barely sort of get away from your house. So you had a captive audience. That's not the case now as we get back to normal. So back then it was fairly easy to just create that content. I mean, we'd do a live, you know, Facebook live, you know, live stream, and we'd have, you know, a couple hundred people watching. And then, you know, the content would sit up there, and, you know, it would just gather sort of steam. And sure enough, you have 1,000, you know, 1,000 viewers, you know, after a fact. But I think you're right. I think now we need to apply some more marketing sort of metrics, you know, to this to see what is actually really impactful, what is engaging, you know, what is of value. I'm not a super creative, you know, person. I often sit in these sort of marketing sort of brainstorm, you know, boardroom, you know, meetings or Zoom meetings with people who are way more creative than me. And I'm going, how did they even think of that? I'm just more of a doer. So if someone comes up with a great sort of creative idea, like I'm all in to actually like to do it. But in terms of what the creative idea is, I'm usually the sort of the laggard in the room with nothing really going on in my brain about that. But I think you're right. I think it needs some rationalization and it needs to be figured out. And it's going to be different for every, you know, every event. I mean, the Boston Marathon, you know, they don't need to do anything like this because it's the Boston Marathon, or the London Marathon, you know, marquee events are in a different category than some, you know, larger local event. They're going to have to come up with something, you know, something different.
Thank you.
Well, Steve, this has been a fantastic conversation. And what I take away from it really is that sense of, you know, thinking about how you can how people can continue to engage outside of, you know, the one day. And I think that's a lesson that really applies to all businesses, whether it's an event or even it's sort of a transactional thing. How can we engage, you know, clients and customers beyond, you know, that one thing so that, you know, they do think of us the next time around, they have another, you know, choice to make about what to buy. I think also too that, you know, that resilience and the sense of, you know, I loved your description about what you were doing with, you know, with Triathlon, about the sense of pioneering and, you know, being part of something is, you know, truly a lesson that applies as well. So Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Simon. This has been a thoroughly enjoyable conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's superb. And it's great to feel across the airwaves, the energy and passion. And I kind of get it. You know, you're living the dream because you do the sport and you've got all the energy and enthusiasm around that. So really impressive. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great summary because I love what I do. And yeah, there's a bit of work or a lot of work I have to do behind the scenes to make it all happen. But when I'm on the microphone at a race or event, that's special time for me. I love doing that with a great deal of passion and enthusiasm.
You're one of those rare people who found your passion early in life and you've pursued it all along. But you also made a really conscious choice 6 or 7 years ago to say, I'm going to do that. And that notion of pursuing passion is something that people talk about, something that people think about, but few people actually do it. So can you just share with us a little bit about what you did, why you did it, and what you've learned?
Great question. I think about that a lot, sometimes every day, Michael. And part of it is my hand was forced. I was abruptly let go from a sales position with a company that had been sold. And I was kind of out on my own. And I'd been through that cycle of, you know, working for companies, you know, in a sales roles or other roles and, you know, the company sold or there's, you know, a big decline in that particular business sector and they let a whole bunch of staff go. And I said, I don't want to do this again. You know, it's frustrating because you work your butt off and I think I'm a good worker. I'm sort of working hard to, you know, represent the business or the brand that I'm representing at the time. And then suddenly you're cut adrift for no fault of your own. And I didn't want to go through that cycle again. So a good friend of mine, who's also a bit of a business mentor, had suggested to me, well, why don't I blow up the race and the event announcing? Because I'm already doing that on the side. And I was bringing in, I think, I don't know, maybe $10,000 a year, like literally just charging, you know, my clients an honorarium, you know, to show up and, you know, announce at the events. And this particular business mentor, he also ran a business himself and he fronted up some money for me. I don't think I would have done this if he hadn't have done this. He was very gracious, very generous to do this. And he needed a bit of help as well. He, you know, works in a business where he's always looking for new leads to sort of work on. And I just sort of did some lead generation for him. And that's work that I do to this day for him. If I find a lead that's a good fit for his particular service offering, I send it on to him. You know, I get a commission check down the road. But it was the fronted up money for about a half a year that was really powerful and potent for me. Not everyone's going to get that, but that was kind of, you know, my backstop to kind of do this. I then went out and I pitched one big triathlon race series locally here in the Ontario area. And lo and behold, they said, yes, we'd love to have you come, Steve, and do like all of our races. And we agreed to, you know, a dollar amount per race and event. And it just sort of, it went from there. And I just kept lining up sort of more and more races and events. And it was kind of lean, the sort of the first, you know, the first year or two, but then, you know, it just kept sort of building up. And now in a typical year, the sort of the last sort of normal year that I had, 2019, I'm on the microphone at 35, wow, you know, plus, you know, races and events in a given calendar year. I'm kind of at max amount, Michael, because, you know, there's not many free weekends that I have, and, you know, you want to have some free time for yourself. But 35 to 40 is about the sort of the maximum I think that I can, you know, I can handle. And you kind of work out a fee, you know, everyone wants a number, and, you know, what do you charge? And I did sort of take a step down in terms of my overall income that I was sort of bringing in, you know, every year. But, you know, you're self-employed, and like in the United States, the same in Canada, there's some, you know, incentives and business write-offs that you can do to sort of make the impact of working on your own a little bit less onerous than when you're an employee. So that's essentially what I've done. And I don't think I would ever, you know, go back to being an employee. Anyone who might want to hire me, I don't know if I'm, you know, for something down the road, might not want to listen to this, but yeah, once you're out sort of working for yourself in a self-employed or, you know, entrepreneurial, you know, kind of way, as you know, Michael, it's very difficult to go back and be sort of an employee just getting, you know, getting a paycheck. It's a very different sort of mindset. And I don't think I would want to go back there unless the opportunity was just right.
So is there, you know, one or two things you feel like if someone's considering that track of, you know, sort of pursuing their passion, not necessarily, you know, race announcing or event emceeing per se, but other things, is there one or two things that you would tell them that they should think about in advance or as they go through this journey?
Well, I was really lucky to have this benefactor really sort of step in at just the right time at, you know, the key point in this when I kind of did step off the cliff. So that was super helpful. And I know everyone's not going to have that, but if you can, you know, have that, however you want to, you know, structure it. Maybe it's a, you know, a family member, maybe it's a loan from the bank. I don't know, but it is nice to have, you know, that sort of, you know, money sort of fronted up to make the decision-making, you know, easier. And the other thing is, and I've read books on this is, and, you know, articles about it is maybe you don't step off, you know, the cliff, you keep the full-time job going until you get the passion play, the moonlight gig paying enough that it makes sense for you to step off. That's the more cautious and conservative approach. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that. That is, I believe, a more pragmatic way of going about this. Then you just step away from the full-time work and you slip nicely into the passion play and the stuff you really like doing, and the money, you know, the money is there. But I mean, let's be clear. I mean, you have to have, you know, the money, you know, there. People have bills to pay, responsibilities, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So these are important decisions, you know, to be made. And I think every person in every situation, Michael, is a little bit different. Like my situation was my situation. That could be completely different, you know, from someone else with a different service or product offering that they're trying to get going in that sort of moonlighting passion play business that they're trying to make their full-time gig.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I mean, Steve, it was interesting reading about the rise in entrepreneurship in some countries during COVID. And some of that, I think, was for some people, they were forced. You know, they lost their job and they had to do something. And,
yep,
you know, they probably may not have gotten to that point had it not been the, you know, the nudge of a lost job or whatever. But still a huge respect for, you know, for people that make that, you know, make that transition. So, Well, Steve, thanks so much for the time. It's been really enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to hearing you online and you know, on the CBC and all that kind of stuff for events to come.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's been a massive pleasure. Really enjoy what you do with the What I Wish I Knew podcast, and it's just been so much fun chatting with both you and Simon today.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.